you as the operator, you as the founder, have to fall in love with the idea or the problem that you're trying to solve.
I am unwilling to give up, that I will start over from scratch as many times as it takes to get where I want to be.
You just want to make sure you will get knocked down, but just make sure you don't get knocked out.
So your only choice should be go focus on what you can control.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. Join me each week for inspiring conversations with some of the world's greatest leaders. We'll talk with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and really some of the most interesting people of our time. Can't wait to get started. Let's go. Hi, everyone. It's Kara Golden from The Kara Golden Show, and I'm so excited to have my next guest here. We have Lucy DeLand, who is one of the founding partners at Inspired Capital, but also one of the founding team members at Paperless Post, which is this awesome, awesome, awesome company that I have known about and used for many, many, many years. And she was at the last decade was their chief operating officer, and I'm sure had tons and tons of learnings. You guys were disrupting in so many amazing ways. And she built and led the finance, customer insights, and operations, strategic planning and marketing, and driving the company's growth to a network of 100 million. Amazing on a lot of fronts.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, super, super excited. And then I also am really excited to hear, because I think it's something that so many people sort of think about in their next career move is, you know, what do you do next after you've done lots of great founding and had really great roles as you did? So I'm super excited to talk about Inspired Capital as well. And yeah, so let's get started. But welcome.
Thank you so much. Again, I'm very excited to be here.
What was sort of the backstory? I mean, you graduated from Harvard. You like, tell me a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually went right into VC and the investment side from undergrad, and really thought that I was bypassing a step, you know, going through the finance, investment banking step, and I just got lucky and was vaulted right into venture capital. I always loved technology, innovation, the excitement of growth, and so was thrown into the deep end there, and actually found when I was there that what I really coveted and who I wanted to be when I grew up were the management teams that were sitting across the table from me.
Interesting.
And that their jobs seemed so exciting and, you know, willing these companies into existence, growing them to employ hundreds of employees, building, you know, products that hadn't existed before. That seemed like a really cool job to have. And equal and opposite, I felt like even if I was going to sit back in the investor seat, that experience would be invaluable. That if I was going to advise companies, work with entrepreneurs, that having been in their seat before was, at least for me, going to be a really crucial step for building up the skill set I wanted to have to be able to be back on that side of the table. But that was really not what I was thinking about at that time. I was really thinking, how do I get into that founder seat? So over a couple of years of evaluating hundreds of businesses, started speaking to a couple of friends about the concept they were throwing around, which was sort of the transformation and digitization of the stationery world and bringing on this sort of what we saw as the last communication that had not yet found its way into a digital format. And so in the fall of 2008, took the leap, and we started raising our seed round as the world absolutely crumbled around us.
I was going to say, such a great time. Good times, right?
we incorporated the company on the day that Lehman collapsed, which was definitely not on purpose.
In New York City, too.
In New York City, yes. Oh, just 40 blocks south of where we were.
Oh my gosh, crazy, crazy. And so what were you... like, what did you think that day? Do you remember? Were you just, oh my gosh, what did I just do?
Well, actually, as I was considering jumping into this world and, you know, in New York, 2008, finance had been flying high up until that point. Entrepreneurship really had not taken hold in this city quite yet. And so everyone sort of thought I was a little bit insane for leaving this cushy, exciting job for this sort of unknown path. And, you know, you tell someone you work at Paperless Post in 2008, everyone gives you a blank stare.
I call them the doubters, right? They're all thinking you're a little crazy. You'd be fun to get a glass of wine with still, but they think you're sort of nuts, right?
Yeah, and maybe you're even more fun to get a glass of wine with because you are that nuts.
Yeah.
And then as this landscape started to shift so dramatically underneath all of our feet in New York, it was kind of reassuring. I was like, okay, so nobody has higher ground. We're all here trying to make it work. You know, I have my friends from Lehman who are getting laid off. I've got friends at other banks that are freaked out. And I was like, well, jump into this scary world with me then. This is the moment and time. Like, when would be a better time to take a huge risk? When the safe places are disappearing.
Yeah, there really are no safe places. So my father actually was I call him a frustrated entrepreneur within a large company growing up. And I watched him just really think about, gosh, if I left, you know, back in his day, it was like you had one job.
You were a lifer.
Maybe two, right? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the stress of picking your like only job at age 21? I talk to my kids about this all the time. Like, you think you got stress? Like, imagine, you know, whatever, 60 years ago when you were trying to make a decision. And I mean, that's a lot, right? I mean, that was just, it's crazy. Yeah. But then he was actually laid off after he had developed a product, which is still alive today, called Healthy Choice. And he was laid off by his company. He had been through an acquisition. Mm-hmm. Initially, Healthy Choice was in a company called Armour Food Company, and they were acquired by ConAgra. And he was laid off for not having an MBA. It was
for
just
not checking
who,
all the...
Yeah, for not checking. Mm-hmm. And never in a million years did he think that? And again, he really believed that there was job security. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I bring that up because I think it's something that more and more people are seeing, that it's, you got to go do what you love and go jump into something that you're really learning and all of those
and
things.
Swing for it. Yeah. Right. Because safety is can be an illusion.
It's a total illusion. So how did you come up with the idea?
So my co-founder, James Hirschfeld, came up with it on his 21st birthday as he was throwing sort of the first formal, you know, I'm inviting people to a party that he'd ever had, and kind of got to the end of the process and found that there was no way that really made sense, he thought, for, you know, this was probably back in early 2008, late 2007, that made sense for today. And he is someone who is high design. But he was also a 21-year-old man who was not going to go invest in paper. He didn't know his friends' addresses. And so it really started as a very micro use case. Mm-hmm. And he looked out and said, I think that if I, as a, you know, guy trying to invite 100 college kids to a party, feel this need, then I believe that there is a whole host of people who are organizing much more important events who have embraced the internet that would be really happy to still have. And what we always sort of prioritized was design and self-expression, something that really represented them well, but allowed them to get instant responses, have a really carbon neutral footprint. You know, maybe we've come to the day and age where we shouldn't fly pieces of paper around in order to invite people to events, and believe that we could get there without sacrificing the look and feel. And today that makes a ton of sense. Back in 2008, designing live in the browser was not yet a concept that existed. Paperless was really on the forefront of the concept of being able to design something and watch it come to life as you were doing so. Adobe, everything else was a desktop environment where you had to download an application or, you know, put it in a CD-ROM. And those were so hard to use. You had to be a designer. And what we really wanted to bring to life was the idea that you had something in your mind. We could give you enough tools and enough guidance and templates that you could create something you were proud of and do so within Internet Explorer 9 or whatever we were dealing with back then, which was still pretty primitive browser technology as well.
Yeah, super primitive. So how did he find you?
So he decided to start the company with his sister, Alexa Hirschfeld, who was a great friend of mine at Harvard. And so when they were batting around ideas and I was working in venture, we would just meet on the weekends, nights, weekends, and brainstorm and come up with ideas. And like all of the best partnerships in life, it really came about organically that I ended up joining the team because we knew that the match was there, that the chemistry was there. And I would, you know, people come and ask me for advice on joining co-founding teams where there is a married couple or siblings or cousins. And I was like, I can't give you advice. You have to go find your own chemistry. It's not about whether or not they're siblings or whether or not they're married. It's got to be the right people. And I was so fortunate to find that. And then I think actually, because they were siblings, you know, the honesty, the raw honesty that you get in a sibling relationship sort of was extended to me, and I was brought into the fold, meaning that we could have incredibly difficult conversations, heated debates, you know,
without
throwing around a lot of ultimatums, and then be like, okay, so are we going to get pizza or Indian food?
Yeah. Well, I work with my husband. My husband's our chief operating officer. And so we've had, you know, we started Hint 15 years ago. And something I talk about on a lot of the podcasts that I do is that was the thing that we heard from so many potential investors early on, was that we were a married couple and, you know, they didn't really invest in married couples. I now sort of have an opinion that that's not necessarily why they didn't invest, right?
That it was a nice, easy thing for them.
It was an easy out, right? Like it's just this, and I tell this to entrepreneurs all the time that if they're, you know, oftentimes people just, they just don't want the conflict, right? They don't want, they want something that they know that you'll believe, but it's not necessarily exactly what was going on. The root of the thing. And I remember my husband saying to me, you know, we had both come from tech. We had never had raised money before, but he's a Silicon Valley attorney. He had been in plenty of rooms with people. And anyway, it was fascinating. And we ended up raising money in lots of different other ways.
And being very successful.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and there's always ways to do it, but I think it's just another wall. And I often talk about, you know, the doubts, as I mentioned earlier, you're always going to, if you believe something, you'll attract people who will also say things, you know, that will make you doubt it even more, but you have to figure out how to break through those things and get around it. So I love hearing that, because I think it's so true that the conversations that go on around our company are very honest, and we don't hedge. And sometimes
to the point,
we seem like brother and sister. We're like, you know, we're not screaming at each other, but we're saying, "No, you're wrong." You know, sorry.
Yeah, there's a psychological safety to be wrong versus
and that's okay.
I see where you're coming from, but
sorry, you're still wrong. You know, and we still go on with it, and we laugh and everything. But I think, to your point, you guys all had different skill sets. And I think that's the most important thing, is being able to really have different skill sets, and really exciting. So you also attended that little school in Massachusetts the same time, I guess, that Mark Zuckerberg was there. So did you ever run into, were you part of the social network, or?
He was my class, though he left pretty quickly after this little thing called Facebook took off. But it was incredible to watch it from, you know, user zero really take off like wildfire on our campus, and understand the implications. I remember I was walking through the dorms with my roommate at the time, and she and I had just become roommates a few weeks earlier because it was October, and everyone was wishing her happy birthday, and we were juniors. And I just turned to her and I was like, I mean, I know it's your birthday, but literally, how does everyone know it's your birthday? And she was
so
like,
funny.
Facebook. You know, everyone woke up that morning and there was not that much else on there. So they told you it was someone's birthday, and they kind of told you who was on. And that was it. It was just sort of a set of profiles of people. And that was sort of the only alert that you would get. And I was like, wow, that's such a different experience to have a birthday now than last year. And I mean, that's sort of the understatement of the impact of Facebook of the decade. But I think what happened in our class and the classes around us was that there was this halo effect of watching him and a couple of other classmates go and start this and my co-founder from Paperless has a joke that the rest of us were, you know, still figuring out the best class schedule configuration. And he was on to his second 100 million, and all of us kind of looked up and we're like, oh, we should do that.
Well, sometimes it just takes us all like longer, right, to like go and figure it out. I mean, but that's it's such a crazy example, but it's it's pretty funny that you guys were there at the same time and that you saw it taking off. I've really wondered actually if people really got it. Like, I've met other people before who have been around people who were founders of companies and they didn't really know it was happening. Right. They didn't know that the service was happening or the product was actually happening. And it sounds like you did.
It was definitely, it became a conversation piece. And it was, you know, this was even among small numbers, but it was just a transformation of how you could follow and interact and communicate with people in the early days. And it was just clear that it was better than Friendster. And you couldn't quite put your finger on why, but it had that, it instantly was a zeitgeist on the campus.
That's wild. I was at America Online until 2001. And I mean, I was there when Instant Messenger was there, and it was the same kind of thing. It was, no matter what else was going on, I was running e-commerce and shopping partnerships, and no matter what was going on, I mean, I knew that instant message was just going to be a huge thing. I mean, which ultimately ended up being texting, right? I mean, that's essentially...
I was going to say, there are so many products today that are just aspiring to get back to AIM.
Totally. Yeah. And it's so interesting. But I remember when you feel the wave, you know, coming in, it's just, it's hard to describe, but you're like, oh yeah, that's really cool. And then you watch it and see that hockey stick. It's pretty exciting. So that's really cool though, that you were there. That's super, super cool. So you left Paperless Post and you decided to go back to investing. And so what was kind of your thinking there?
As I was transitioning from Paperless, I knew that I had this itch to build my next sort of venture. And I couldn't have told you then what that meant, because when I was an operator, I was very heads down. I wasn't sort of keeping lots of different pots boiling. I was heads down at work, and I might have been advising a few CEOs and founders outside, but kept it pretty lean. And so it was like, I'm going to take 6 months off and really figure out where I want my next decade to take me. I've had such an amazing decade. How do I top it? That was a little bit of a daunting feat to think about that. And then also, you know, what do I really want out of it? And had the great fortune of sort of timing that exploration with my great friend and now business partner, Alexa Von Tobel, who was leaving Northwestern Mutual. And she and I had been one another's sort of closest external colleague, closest confidant on this founder journey over the past decade. You know, the person that you call late at night when you really need to work through a problem and you need some external perspective on what you're dealing with. And we provided that for each other through the LearnVest and Paperless journeys. And so I think I ended up in her office talking about this venture firm that she was thinking about bringing into reality weeks after my last day at Paperless. And like all the best partnerships, it really started to snowball and become an organic conversation about how I would build it, what I would do, how would I prioritize, and sort of built the foundation of becoming a partner at Inspired really organically.
I love it. She was a CEO, right? She wasn't an operations. Yeah. So different skills that
different skills, two. Different perspectives.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. And how big is your fund?
So we have a $200 million early stage fund. So we focus on seed and series A. And we have been around for about 2 years now. I think we just had our second birthday 2 weeks ago, and which seems impossible, but here we are. And we invest about 1 to 3 million into seed companies and about 5 to 10 million into Series A.
That's awesome. I feel like so often when I've talked to different venture capitalists, they actually haven't had the operations experience that you've had. Do you feel that that is super useful? I mean, I would imagine that, especially with your portfolio and trying to figure out how people are building.
To me, it's an incredibly important experience that I go back to all the time in thinking about this, and is a really important influencing factor on why we chose the stage of investment that we did. Not only do we think that it's the most interesting place to put our dollars, but we feel that our experience willing companies into existence, sort of transforming a category, really is well suited to help entrepreneurs who are really early in their journey, really establishing product market fit, and figuring out how both they're going to scale the company, how they're going to build the model that scales, but also how they're going to scale themselves and move from being in a building and doing mode, which you have to be in the early days, into a leading and managing and vision setting mode exclusively. And I think that there are great investors who sit at all parts of the capital stack, many that bring in different vantage points than I have. I would say there are probably, you know, lots of people who are going to lead your Series C that have really important vantage points about growth capital and IPO markets that I'm not going to bring to the table, and vice versa. I have really important experience on how you truly build an organization to build the company that you want to create. And I think that can go across any company building experience. It doesn't have to be sector focused.
What would you tell one of your portfolio companies or somebody who's just going out and raising money for the first time, knowing you've been on both sides of the table? Mm-hmm. What do you think are the things that are really important?
I think you, as the operator, you as the founder, have to fall in love with the idea or the problem that you're trying to solve. And that is crucial. And you have to remember that the investor is actually betting on you. Mm-hmm. I think rightfully so, founders get really, really invested in their ideas and the products that they want to build and the problems that they're going to solve. And they need to sell that to the investor, but they have to remember that at the end of the day, they're the bet. Mm-hmm. And that the greatest idea is only, like, its limitation is going to be the person that is setting out on this journey. And so I think founders really need to focus on, how am I going to tell my story so that this investor understands why I'm the person to bet on to go solve this problem? And that they really understand me, my strengths, my weaknesses. Everyone, you know, nobody has intense strengths without weaknesses. So it is not about masking, you know, who you are. It is about actually amplifying it so the investor really understands why you're going to achieve really superhuman feats, which is often what is required, particularly in the early days, to get a venture off the ground, to hire people that are more talented than you deserve to be able to hire, to get your first customers to take a chance on you, to bring a product truly to life, to the quality that you have from your head actually into the real world. All of those things usually take more than just doing hard work. They take, you know, that extra, and you need to really demonstrate to the investor base that you're going to bring that extra.
And how do you pick the investor? I mean, how do you, if you have a choice, which I think you always have a choice, but how do you...
I was going to say, at least keep it in your mind that you have the choice.
Right.
The other thing I would say is, when you are raising money, know that this is your process to run. Mm-hmm. We as investors are participating in your process. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to look to us to how you want to run it. You should really take the reins on it. And similarly, you should treat every conversation with an investor both like they're evaluating you, and equal and opposite, you are evaluating them.
Totally.
How leaned in on you and the idea are they? How good are the questions they ask? And I think that's actually one of the greatest indicators, is can they get to that next level of really asking questions that show that, yeah, they get the high level, but really they understand on a deeper level what it's going to take to get this company done. Because you also want investors that understand and embrace the hard stuff you're going to have to do.
Yeah, I think that that's so true. I think that the other thing, just to add on to what you're saying, that I've noticed too, especially when I was going out initially, you get sort of, you know, you hear these names, right? Somebody hears that you're going out and raising money. Sometimes they'll call you. Sometimes a friend will introduce you. And mm-hmm. you really have to look at the companies that they've invested in. Mm-hmm. Because that's, I've found, I never had a problem actually getting the meeting. Maybe some people have problems getting meetings. I never had problems getting the meetings. But mm-hmm. that's 1 hour of your time or more. Mm-hmm. By the time you actually, you know, go there, come back, 2 hours, right? Or maybe mm-hmm. more. And I think that time is the most valuable thing that founders have.
And yeah, that any of us have, but founders in particular, because, yeah, you know, you're raising money to buy yourself time.
Totally. Yeah. So things like stages, for example, like what you were talking about, are things that the newbie person going out and looking for money, you don't really know what stage is and mm-hmm. how important that is. So if somebody still wants to take the meeting with you, you're a brand new company and they do later stage, probably not worth your time if you have, you know, limited time. Do you agree?
I think that just to add on to what you're saying, if you can find someone who's inside the venture or in whatever mm-hmm. investment community you're going to speak to, where you can say, can you just take down the curtain for me and tell me what the market looks like right now? Tell me, kind of what's happening in terms of what does a seed mean today? What does a Series A mean today? Who's doing them? What are they looking like? Because one of the things, you know, that's the landscape is shifting all the time. So even if you knew venture 3 years ago, to your example, there are late stage funds that are now doing seed rounds. Mm-hmm. So optically, it might not look like it makes sense to meet with a later stage fund, but given recent trends, it actually would. And so I think if you can find that sort of like insider who you say, I'm not trying to raise from you, I just want a half an hour to get you to sort of give me the inside baseball on what you're seeing and what should I call this round? What is, if I say that I'm raising a $2 million Series A, what does that signal to the market? And a lot of times they can kind of say like, okay, this is how people are going to think about you. This is where they're going to bucket you. Don't say you're raising a $2 million Series A. That was a joke and not a good example. And so I think that that can be really helpful from the founder seat. And I think that's one of the things we try and arm our portfolio members with, is a little bit of the mindset that everyone's going to come into their meetings with.
That's great advice.
Because we know from being in a founder seat, in the operator seat, that sometimes it's kind of a mystery why certain firms react with unbounded enthusiasm and someone else doesn't. And then you find out in retrospect that you could have predicted those outcomes.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. What are some of the current consumer-facing trends that you're focusing on right now?
I have been looking a lot at consumer tech that is really driven at personal productivity or sort of personal time management that benefits a lot from social dynamics. So we have an investment in a company called Saturn, which is a calendar app for high schoolers. So managing those block floating schedules that just makes life easier, but also introduces sort of collaborative task management. How do you keep track of all your homework with your classmates? Where is your friend? Oh, they're in building B while I'm in building A. So has a social dynamic and is sort of like the first productivity app for a 14-year-old to manage the work that they're doing outside of just notes app on their phone. And then another, which is going to launch later this spring, which is geared towards parents and organizing and sharing the load of managing the household and how you sort of unearth all the work that is being done, both to make it more manageable, but also to be able to, you know, more easily answer that age old question. How can I help? You seem busy.
Yeah, exactly. How old, and you have two kids, right?
I do. I have a 3-year-old and a 7-month-old.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I have four that are significantly older.
Amazing.
So I have three in college and one in high school. So I'm listening
to you. So you managed through all of this already flawlessly.
Yeah. I started Hint when I had four kids under the age of six. And so
So you had five kids under the age of six.
Yeah. I was not the profile that most people wanted to invest in. And the best thing is honestly when I ran into those people who didn't really think I could do it, frankly. Mm-hmm. And now they look at it and they say they were wrong. I mean, it's just, you know, and I'm like, that's okay. At least you owned it. You know?
Yeah. I was like, well, good for them, because there are also a group of people who, you know, have wonderfully terrible memories who are like, I always knew you were going to do it. And you're like, no, you literally didn't.
I remember that meeting. And it really was not the meeting. Mm-hmm. And
and now it's hard for me to say this on the so now that I sit on the investor side of the table, but we did always come out of every fundraise with one person's face on the dartboard. We were like, it's just important. They've given us a gift. They're the person that we're going to prove wrong in the next chapter. We never failed to happen too.
Well, I always feel like too, and I mean, this sort of stretches to so many other examples as well, but I always feel that generally when you're getting feedback in some of these meetings, I mean, on the one hand, I say some of these meetings aren't really worth your time, but actually there's a lot of meetings where you may disagree with 90% and you just don't think it's really a great thing. But I always feel like even the challenging ones where I want to have somebody on the dartboard or I find I'm having somebody on the dartboard, there might've been something that somebody says in there that is a little bit true. I'm always the one that's trying to pull that stuff out and learn from it, right? And get better. And that's what I did in all of those meetings. And so, and then later on, and when I would run into them, I'd say, no, I actually remember you saying this. And they say, how do you remember that? And I said, you know, founders, when we're raising money, we actually remember a lot
everything.
Of things.
No. And actually, I think the fundraising process, and I don't just say this as an investor, I did say this as an operator, is a really special time for reflection, zooming out, getting out of the weeds. And each process can bring you sort of to a new level of understanding, both through the feedback that you get, but also through just being in this exercise of constantly explaining the vision in a way that when you're sitting with your employees and you're all bought in and you're all just, you know, fighting another day, you don't sort of get that time and space to necessarily have those high level conversations every day.
And you're not going to have everybody telling you that your baby's pretty along the way, especially the more serious ones. But I always say to founders, like the key thing is to brush yourself off. Right. And keep moving and whatever. Know that there's other people that are going to love you. And, you know, but it's a lot.
And some people ask me how to know if they're ready to start a company. And I say to them, well, do you really want everyone to think that this is a fabulous idea? And do you want everyone to be really proud of you? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, then you're not ready. You need to be ready for everyone to tell you it's a terrible idea and to tell you that your baby is like a little wonky and you need to just not care, listen to it and be able to take in that information. Like you said, and sounds like you're good at find the kernels of truth, use them to make it better. But have that sort of internal locus of motivation, confidence, and it needs to be there. Otherwise it's already a hard road, as you know.
Yeah. And I think it's just it's something that you just have to, it's a learning experience and you have to immerse yourself into it. And, you know, I think that the best learnings come where you feel a little bit uncomfortable, right? And just in general, and that's what fundraising is. And I mean, frankly, I've done it for 15 years. I'm the first person to tell people that, including investors, that I don't like raising money. It's just not what I enjoy doing at all, but I've gotten really good at it. And I continue to just go and do it. And
It's necessary.
It's necessary.
It's okay if you don't enjoy raising money. You have to enjoy running the company.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to know that you're going to go out and raise the capital.
And that's exactly what I do and where my head has been at for a long time. But so COVID, obviously for everybody, I mean, all going on a year, which is so crazy, right?
And as we're starting to get close to these anniversaries.
Right. It's nuts. I mean, I remember very clearly I was closing down my New York office and I flew out from San Francisco on March 11th and shut down before the really, while everybody was shutting down, I'll never forget that week on a lot of levels. And we hadn't closed San Francisco yet because it really was a lot worse in New York than it was in San Francisco. And of course, we found that out later. And then coming back that next week into San Francisco and really kind of feeling the effects of offices closing down. 15% of our business went away. Luckily, we had sort of other revenue streams coming into the company, and which ultimately ended up growing our company significantly. But it was what did you see, and what do you think are the big shifts that you saw just in companies?
I think a lot of companies that we were looking at that were pursuing a model where they believed that there was still an importance in brick and mortar or some in-person experience, and that they would have a digital sort of arm to it, mm-hmm. or a software play, very quickly, you know, quadrupled down into the software element in a way that maybe would have taken 5 years,
totally.
To really embrace it and really say, this is a number one priority, such as we have an investment in a company called Chief that is all around. It's like a YPO model senior women.
That's great.
And they had in-person meetings for their cohorts, and obviously they had to shift. And I think in so many ways that is going to be a long-term transformation of a lot of business models towards really deeply embracing software as the delivery mechanism and flipping any brick and mortar or physical into, you know, a nice to have or a different role that it plays. It will not eliminate it forever, but it really accelerated the focus onto that. And so I think that that's been good, and that might have also like bolstered the confidence of some of those CEOs that, you know, we can build a really good software product here and our customers are ready for it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's still a link missing for a lot of these people, though, that were, as you kind of described, that they were thinking about it as an add-on to their existing business. And I think that the piece that so many of these people are missing is that while it's just as important, and maybe during a pandemic, it, you know, sort of makes up for things, I think that the data side, there's so many people that just don't really know what that is and sort of why it's important. They're just allowing others to kind of take their data. And I mean, so many people just, at least in my industry, think that going online is just working with Amazon, right? And they think they've solved it and it's all
great.
And
it's just a logistical problem, not a...
Right. They just don't really understand it, and especially the physical goods side of it. And so it'll be interesting. I think there's still growth to be had there, and maybe there's some new companies. I keep looking at what are those new companies that will crop up out of that, because I think that there's just definitely this whole operation side of things that I think so many of them don't get. And it's not just about throwing a lot of ad dollars at Facebook or Google. Yes, you need to probably do that too, but
yeah, that's one, that's a very like shallow first step.
Right. And how can you just get better at ultimately understanding what I keep saying over and over again, my biggest learnings from 2020 is that the customer is really in control more and more about how they shop, what services they buy. And, you know, I just think it's so, so crystal clear. So it's really super interesting. So best piece of advice you have for entrepreneurs and founders?
This is advice for the day-to-day or the year-to-year, but run towards the hardest thing first. So I think as people, we have sort of a psychological habit of, you know, ticking off the stuff we know we can do. And it's sort of, I think in the entrepreneur seat, in the founder seat, you have to go towards the problem that you're not really sure how you're going to solve. And go solve that part of the customer experience. And similarly, you know, the part of being a founder is as soon as you know someone else on your team can do it, it's got to be off your plate. No matter how good you are at it, it's got to be delegated. And so I think you said it earlier, you know, the place you learn the most is outside your comfort zone. And so founders learn to live exclusively outside your comfort zone, outside of your skill zone, and outside of your company's comfort zone at all times, because those are usually the most important things to be doing.
I think that's so true. And I think that you touched on another thing that I always tell founders and CEOs that I think is really critical, though, is understanding a little bit about everything. Because if a person in your company leaves, or, you know, there's a problem that they are having a really challenging time fixing, if you can actually get in there and try and figure out, even if it's not your lane, you can come in and
go in and
value.
Support and be helpful. And I think that's also very crucial for hiring as well. where you are going to hire the better talent, be able to evaluate it more, the more you expose yourself to every part of the business.
I think that's so critical. I totally, mm-hmm. totally agree. Well, this is amazing advice. Mm-hmm. And I love hearing just that you went from one industry and finance into mm-hmm. a company and then went back to finance. Do you think you'll ever go in-house at a company again?
I think I'm pretty heads down for the next couple of decades, but never say never. And yeah. I also love building companies, so I would never cross it off the list.
Well, you're in a great position too, because especially in that early stage, these companies need help mm-hmm. and support. So it's yeah. fun.
I know I'm in the privileged position where I get to work with a bunch of founding teams all the time and get those high highs and those low lows, and they come fast and furious, both at the same time often.
That's super true. So, well, great. Well, thank you so much, Lucy, for coming on, and everybody mm-hmm. give Lucy 5 stars and definitely come back and see us on Mondays and Wednesdays every week. We're meeting with lots of amazing people with great insights and different interesting journeys that some are actually none are really a straight line. I feel like the most interesting people that we have are sort of bouncing around and doing things not exactly the way that everybody does it, which is really, really interesting. So
to those who can career plan that well, I give you kudos.
I love it. And where do people find you too?
You can find me at lucy@inspiredcapital.com into my inbox, or actually, my Twitter handle is confusing because it is my maiden name, Lucy Grayson, @Lucy, Grayson.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you so much. And we'll see you all very soon.
Thank you so much, Kara.
Thank you. Before we sign off, I want to talk to you about fear. People like to talk about fearless leaders, but achieving big goals isn't about fearlessness. Successful leaders recognize their fears and decide to deal with them head on in order to move forward. This is where my new book, Undaunted, comes in. This book is designed for anyone who wants to succeed in the face of fear, overcome doubts, and live a little undaunted. Order your copy today at undauntedthebook.com and learn how to look your doubts and doubters in the eye and achieve your dreams. For a limited time, you'll also receive a free case of Hint Water. Do you have a question for me or want to nominate an innovator to spotlight? Send me a tweet @Kara Golden and let me know. And if you like what you heard, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow along with me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn @Kara Golden. Thanks for listening.